welcome to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, on unceded Coast Salish territories, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, August 8th, 2014. I'm Jackie, and I'm joined here in studio today by Alyssa.
Hello.
And Allison.
Hi there.
This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at cooperadio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. Today, following Pride Week, we will discuss all things queer-related. Alice and I will start by discussing this year's Pride events, including some of my reservations with the current main Pride event. I'll also discuss walking in the Dyke March with a few other awesome women carrying an animal human liberation banner. We'll share an interview with author, animal rescuer, and activist Patrice Jones. Patrice frequently lectures on subjects such as the intersection of racism, speciesism, sexism, and homophobia. We discuss Vine Sanctuary, which she co-founded, queer animals, and the intersection of oppression in the animal liberation movement. So please stay tuned. And Allison, you were marching in the Pride Parade this year.
Yes, I certainly was. It's the second year in the row that I've done it, and actually only the second year in the row that I've ever attended the Pride Parade, which is really quite a spectacular event, I must say. There are hundreds of thousands of spectators at this event. It's really about, it's just like just a really festive atmosphere, and everyone comes out to it. And so I march in the Pride Parade for equality of all beings, and that includes non-human animals. So for the second year in the row, I marched with Mercy for Animals Canada. They are a national nonprofit organization that that promotes animal liberation, animal rights. And again, there were 17 of us marching there for MFA Canada. And we were holding the same banner as last year, which really spoke what the bottom line was of our message, which is no one is free when others are oppressed. And I have to say that the reason that I choose to do this event, I would like to do it every year, is because I really feel that it really gets the message out there just to so many people in such a short amount of time. You know, it took maybe an hour or so just to do that really long route and just pass by thousands and thousands of people. So not only was it the banner, and they were seeing our t-shirts, Mercy for Animals Canada. And I have to say, like, people knew who we were. And I think this is a result of all the undercover investigations that have been broadcast in the media. Most recently, the dairy undercover investigation that actually happened near here in Chilliwack. So a lot of people actually, I realized, actually knew who we were, and they were like, yay, MFA Canada. But we handed out 5,000 leaflets in this short amount of time. So that's what I mean when I say, like, this is really worth my time. And 500 Gardein coupons as well. On the leaflets, it says, you stand for equality, justice, and acceptance. You stand against oppression, violence, and hate. Now it's time to sit down and put your values on the table. So I just really hope that, you know, the majority of the people who are there, that I would say the great majority, they do support rights, equality for all people, and I would hope that would extend to all beings. So I just really feel that these leaflets that we are handing out, which they were all like grabbing for, it was really easy to give them out. People are just like putting their hands out. So I must say it's the easiest leafleting adventure you'll ever like come upon yourself. And I just really hope that those leaflets helped a lot of people just make that connection. Out of 5,000, you would think that definitely some people were reached.
Awesome. Yeah, and I also marched in a march. It was the Dyke March that I walked in with three other women with an animal human liberation banner. And we got some really great reactions. A lot of people were just like, right on, like, wow, that's cool. And, you know, a couple people read it and they were like, animal liberation, awesome, I'm vegan. And just similar things like that. So it was a great event. And as much as, you know, the Pride March is enjoyed by a lot of people, it didn't have that corporate feel that the Pride Parade has. It was a lot smaller scale, a lot more grassroots. And it just kind of ended with a little kind of concert, again, very grassroots, at Grandview Park. And there's a few booths around with some information about different nonprofits in the area. So it was really great. And I recommend, if anyone has the availability next year, to make it out there and join the march. And apparently you get a lot of support with animal liberation message there, which is awesome. And I just had a few words about the Pride Parade, which I did go to this year. I didn't actually watch the parade. I went there to table with a nonprofit, Fur Bearers Defenders, which is a great group. But I had some reservations before going into the Pride Parade. I've noticed, especially in the past few years, that it's become kind of a little bit more of a corporate spectacle in a way. A lot of marketing and companies trying to capitalize off of queer people and their allies, which I have some issue with. I understand that they need the financial support, but it's unfortunate that a lot of the smaller groups or individuals that should be marching in this parade are not able to afford it or are diminished by these huge spectacular floats that the bigger corporations have. And I also question what these large corporations, a lot of them, what they're doing the rest of the year to support queer people, if they're doing anything at all. And I also noticed after the parade, there was a news article that an anti-gay activist, Bill Watcott, who's known and charged for hate speech, was welcomed into the march under a guise to hand out hateful materials to parade goers, which is quite shocking. I'm not fully blaming the Vancouver Pride Society because he was under a guise, but he was able to sneak in there and was harming many people. And it makes me question why they didn't, I guess, thoroughly look through the materials that he was going to be handing out at this parade. And I hope that in future events that the screening process would be more thorough, because I just can imagine the amount of hurt just reading some of what was included in that. I can imagine the amount of hurt that would cause a lot of people. And I also had a bit of issue with the fact that Lucky Charms out of nowhere was a sponsor. It seemed kind of interesting to me.
When you say Lucky Charms, you're referring to the cereal that we, or at least was around when I was a kid. I don't know if I even ever had it. I'm surprised it's still out.
Yeah. I was wondering what they do to support queer people, or is it just because they have a rainbow in their cereal? It seemed kind of like they were really pushing that rainbow.
It's not like
out.
They're even Vancouver or Canadian based. That's it a pretty odd connection.
Really bizarre.
Because they had the money to be in it.
Yeah. So there was that. On the other side, though, there was some great musicians and artists performing there, which is always good. And they had some great parties, which, don't get me wrong, I love a party. I just do still take issue with, I guess, us kind of pretending that we've fully achieved equality in some ways, and that we are allowing corporations to capitalize our events.
The whole Pride Week, Pride events, it's really becoming pretty big. Like, mm-hmm. it's like a huge spectacle. And I don't mean that in a bad or a good way, but that's what it is. It's just like there's so many people mm-hmm. there, and old people, young people, kids, family friendly, you know, people of all types, all genders, all sexual preferences, everyone's out. That's why mm-hmm. I think it was actually a great opportunity for us to do leafleting for the animals, because you'll never get that much of a concentration in Vancouver, very rarely, where you're actually allowed to hand out leaflets, and you're kind of like what you're actually walking down a path, and there's like nothing but seas of people. It's just it is amazing in that sense, but I do find it just to be like it's this I don't know what the origins are of Pride, but it definitely
I do.
Yeah. Okay.
So early on the morning of Saturday, June 28th, 1969, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning persons rioted following a police raid on the Stonewall Inn in the Greenwich Village neighborhood of New York City. The Stonewall Inn was a gay bar that catered to an assortment of patrons, but which was popular most with marginalized people in the gay community, transvestites, transgender people, effeminate young men, hustlers, and homeless youth. The police crashed that party, and the first gay pride parade was a defiant protest. So it has its roots in real, you know, ugly history and serious politics there. And these days you can't see but a glimmer of that. Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge part of my issue with it too, is it's kind of, people have forgotten that there was this huge struggle, and that That is what the origins of this are. And it's just become kind of, like you said, a spectacle for 500,000 people to watch.
That's what it is. Watching crazily dressed people is really, like, you know, not everyone marching in it's queer, but it's just like, it's a lot of eye candy is what it is. Yeah. Like, people just love that. Like, woohoo. Like, I don't know. It's sort of, I think maybe it strays a little bit from the main message for sure.
Definitely.
You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish territories in what is colonially known as Vancouver. So last weekend was Pride. This weekend is Shout Back Festival. Shout Back is an anti-capitalist, DIY, feminist, punk festival that takes place here on unceded Coast Salish territories, happening on August 7th to 10th. It's organized by and for gay and trans, queer people of color, indigenous or women artists. Shout Back is a celebration of smashing patriarchy, a full weekend of workshops, art, live music, and an anarchist book fair. Animal Voices has a table at the book fair. That's Saturday, August tomorrow. No, what is that? The 9th. Saturday, August 9th. So we'll be there at Britannia Gym D. Come say hi to us. And then that evening, Animal Voices and Vancouver Animal Defense League and the Wildlife Defense League are hosting an event called Endangered Turtle and Poisonous Pipes. No pipelines on Turtle Island. So the main questions of this are, what ways are animals put at risk by projects like Northern Gateway and Trans Mountain? And how do we help animals being threatened by the tar sands pipelines? Can we integrate the needs of non-human animals with ongoing campaigns for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental defense? These are all really important questions that I'm looking for answers to, and I want to talk to people about. I don't know. You know, I don't know all the answers to those questions, but I'm excited to host this event and to spark these conversations in our community. This event is totally free. It's at Strathcona Community Center on Kiefer Street. It starts at 6:30 on August 10th, and it's in partnership with the Earthling Liberation Collective, or ELK, who's hosting a much bigger event in Ontario on the same day. As I said, entry is free. We're going to have free vegan cinnamon buns. We're featuring some speakers I will go through quickly here. Dr. David Steele, president of Earth Save Canada, is going to be talking about how pipelines hurt wildlife. And Marcy Potter, who's a wildlife rehabilitator now with Fur Bear Defenders, is going to talk about individual rescue stories and how oil and bitumen affect wild beings. Wild individuals. We'll also have activists from the Wildlife Defense League speaking, and settler activists reporting back from the Unistoten camp. We'll also be screening some films. And to tie into our interview at the Ontario event, they're featuring Patrice Jones, and their event is sponsored by Vine Sanctuary. And Patrice, at their event, is going to be talking about intersectionality in action, situated strategic planning for effective activism. And that will be recorded, and we'll try to post that widely.
Awesome. So that leads us into the interview. Patrice Jones is an ecofeminist, writer, scholar, and activist. As an ecofeminist educator and activist, Patrice frequently lectures on subjects such as the intersections of racism, sexism, speciesism, homophobia, and the exploitation of the environment. Earlier this week, I had the pleasure of speaking with Patrice Jones about Vine Sanctuary, which she co-founded, queer liberation, and its connections with animal liberation.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling me how Vine Sanctuary was started and what its primary mission is?
Well, our sanctuary started almost 15 years ago when my former partner Miriam Jones and I, who still helps to coordinate the sanctuary with me, found a chicken by the side of the road in the part of the United States where factory farming of chicken was invented. And so we picked the bird up and brought her home. And luckily, we did not realize that another sanctuary, United Poultry Concerns, was not very far from us, only 2 or 3 hours. We thought there was nothing that we could do for this bird except give her a home. Decided to open up our home to other survivors of the local poultry industry. And within about 6 months of, within less than 6 months of finding that first bird, we had incorporated as a nonprofit sanctuary. Originally, our name was the Eastern Shore Chicken Sanctuary, and then when we expanded to include ducks and turkeys as well, we changed that to Eastern Shore Sanctuary and Education Center. And then about 5 years ago, we relocated up here to Vermont in order to have more room and to realize our long-standing hope of also offering refuge to survivors of the dairy industry. And at that point, we changed the name to Vine Sanctuary.
Okay,
so,
great.
We began accidentally and grew organically.
Great. And how has Vine evolved since the early days?
How has Vine evolved? We evolved, as I say, organically. At first, our thought was to just offer refuge to survivors of the local poultry industry. We were in a part of the country that was dominated by the poultry industry. We were literally surrounded by factory farms. We were on a little peninsula where they kill and cut up more than 1 million birds every single day. And those birds often fell from or jumped from the trucks headed for the slaughter factory and or escaped when the chicken catchers came to load them into those trucks. And so our initial aim was just to offer refuge to those birds. But then we also had the opportunity to offer refuge to some survivors of egg factories, so we expanded in order to do that, to offer refuge to survivors of the egg industry. Then we got a call from someone who was living in an area where there had just been a bust of a cockfighting ring, and we were asked to take some of the roosters. Now at that point, none of the farmed animal sanctuaries would take former fighting roosters, and most very, very, very strictly limited the number of roosters that they had taken in. But the year before, we had taken in a whole group of 24 roosters who had been living together in a farmhouse in Pennsylvania, aggregated over the years by a humane officer who just couldn't bring herself to kill them, but then lost her land. Mm-hmm. And so between our experiences with the local roosters and our experiences with those 24 roosters of all different varieties, we knew that the things that people believed about roosters not being able to get along with each other just weren't true. Were functions of stereotypes, gender stereotypes that had been mapped onto roosters, who people seem to see as some sort of exemplars of masculinity, and so we thought that that might also be true about fighting roosters. Everybody said that these roosters are just genetically incorrigibly aggressive, can't possibly live with each other or with other roosters without tearing them to shreds. But we suspected, as turned out to be true, that these birds were fighting not because of some sort of inborn aggressiveness, but because they had been socialized and indeed traumatized to be so fearful that they treated other roosters as if they were predators rather than members of their own species. And so we thought that we had an idea about how we could undo that process of socialization and help these birds to learn to live peacefully within flocks, And so we took in a few birds just to test out whether or not our theory about whether they could be rehabilitated would prove to be true, and it worked. So then we became a sanctuary that that did, as space allowed, offer refuge to former fighting roosters and of course, offer them rehabilitation so that they could live with their flocks. And then, as I said, we moved in 2009 up here to Vermont with the aim of expanding. Where we had been living before was a very small property. It was not a property that we had purchased with any thought of a sanctuary, so it was really only a few acres. We wanted to be able to take in even more birds, and we also wanted to offer refuge to survivors of dairy. We felt strongly that neither the feminist movement nor the animal rights movement were paying sufficient attention to gendered forms of animal exploitation, cockfighting, eggs, dairy. And so we were already taking in former fighting roosters. We were already taking in hens from dairying, hens from egg factories, and from small-scale egg production. So we also wanted to take in survivors of dairying. And with the help of a very generous anonymous donor, we were able in pretty short order to obtain the land and erect the buildings that we needed to do to take in survivors of dairying. At this point, we've gone from a small chicken sanctuary to a 100-acre. More than 100-acre refuge offering sanctuary to hundreds of chickens, dozens, indeed scores of pigeons and geese and ducks and turkeys, a couple of emus, almost 40 cows, which is many more cows than most sanctuaries are able to offer refuge to, and a few sheep as well. We do things a little bit differently than other sanctuaries. We don't segregate animals by species. We believe that freedom of association is an important right that all animals have. And so while there are some single species flocks or herds, we've got one very hardy herd of cows who live way up and back in a heavily forested pasture area where they are just as wild as can be, and so they're interacting more with wildlife, so to speak, than they are with other sanctuary residents. And we do have a pigeon aviary, for example, where there's only pigeons, but we also have lots of areas where animals, non-human animals of different species, are able, if they so choose, to form friendships and other caring relationships across species boundaries.
Sounds great. And you said the name Vine was relatively new. How did you come up with that name for the sanctuary?
Oh, gosh. Well, what happened was that we had relocated, and our initial name was Eastern Shore Sanctuary, but now we weren't near any shore at all. And so we had to come up with a new name. And so we liked the idea of vines as we love vines, the plants that grow in vines. We love the way that vines form connections. We love the way that how powerful vines are, how they can snake through walls. And so we went with Vine. And the acronym that we eventually chose to sort of be the catchphrase for Vine is veganism is the next evolution. We actually believe that veganism is not enough, and we almost went with that, and we do absolutely believe that, but we wanted to have a little bit of a more positive name. By veganism is the next evolution, we just mean that veganism is going to be an essential component, has to be an essential component in the struggle for social justice and also in the struggle against climate change.
Great. And what is one of your most memorable rescue stories?
My gosh, there's so many. I think about folks who are here now. Probably the most memorable, the best story of somebody who happens to be living at the sanctuary right now is a cow called Jan, who was being used to breed calves who would then be raised for beef on a small-scale farm. And she was pregnant again, and I guess decided that this was it, that she wasn't going to have this anymore. And so as the time neared for her to give birth to her calf, what she did was jump the fence. And she had her calf in the forest, and then and nursed her calf in the forest, and then found her way to kind people who eventually conveyed her to Farm Sanctuary, and she came from there to us since she seems to be the kind of cow who would appreciate the kind of wild experience we offer. But probably for us the most memorable rescue that we did. For me personally, it's got to be the time that very early on, before we even incorporated as a sanctuary, when I was able to go into a factory farm. I was actually invited to come in and take any chickens that the chicken catchers had left behind, and so I was actually able to be inside the factory farm after the chicken catchers had come, ankle deep in excrement, my eyes streaming from the ammonia fumes, tripping over the dead bodies of birds in various stages of decomposition as I tried to round up those who had been quick enough to evade the chicken catchers. And I knew that if I couldn't catch them, then they would be killed by the farm. But in fact, I was the one who was going to take them to safety. And it took me hours and hours and hours. So that's probably the so there I was at the factory farm, and I came back with the birds, who I had managed to find and put into cat crates to bring back, to our place. And I remember, I'll never forget what I said to Miriam as I walked in the door. She had been out teaching in school. That's what she did to make a living at the time. And so she didn't know where I'd been or what I'd been doing. And I couldn't even begin to explain. All that I could say was, quote, "I'll never be the same person again." Mm-hmm. And so certainly was deeply meaningful to me. Probably for us as an organization, of course, the very first rescue has to be the most amazing and surprising and memorable. The hen who we found by the side of the road actually turned out to be a rooster, and it was pretty comical for us to cluelessly be thinking that this rooster was a hen, even after he started crowing. So we were just really lucky that somebody less clueless than we were happened to clue us in. But that also happened to teach me a really important lesson about the stereotypes that people have about non-human animals that aren't based in anything really at all about the non-human animals. They're based in our ideas about gender, which we map on to non-human animals, and then sort of read back off of the non-human animals as evidence that our ideas about gender are natural rather than the social constructs that they are. Mm. And so we force or we trick animals into behaving in highly gender stereotyped ways. We perceive animals in highly gender stereotyped ways that are rooted deep in our childhoods when we're reading all these storybooks where the non-human animals are presented in highly gender stereotyped ways, always heterosexual. The hens are flighty, and the roosters are arrogant, and the bulls are fierce, and et cetera. And so this becomes almost like a pair of spectacles in between us and the animals we're trying to look at. So it's very difficult to actually perceive non-human animals as they are, unless you are attentive to the ways that your own ideas about gender are going to influence what you pay attention to, how you interpret different forms. And that's something I've been thinking and writing about for years, but it really all started with that first chicken who we were convinced was a hen, and then were so surprised when he turned out to be a rooster, and I had to really interrogate the assumptions that I've been making.
Mm. And you kind of just touched on a bit of what my next question is leading into. I know that you work a lot within an intersectional framework to activism. Particularly, can you share some of the most obvious connections between queer and animal liberation?
I think that, well, first I should say that we started thinking about the intersections between queer and animal liberation for a few different reasons. First of all, as a we started out as a lesbian couple, a lesbian feminist couple. We're now, there's five of us on site, we're all lesbian or bi or transgendered on site, and our supporters include every variety of LGBTQ you can imagine. So, of course, our own identities would make us think about this. But also, as feminists, we understood already that the different forms of oppression among people are interrelated, and so we already understood as feminists that homophobia and transphobia too both serve as sort of the enforcers of sexism. They're the enforcers of gender roles. It almost doesn't matter whether you actually are not heterosexual. It doesn't matter, in terms of what I'm about to say, what your inside your head gender identity might be. All that really matters in terms of whether or not you're going to be gay-bashed or trans-bashed or discriminated against based on your perceived sexual orientation or gender identity, all that really matters for those things is whether or not you conform to gender norms. If you don't conform to gender norms, regardless of who you actually want to have sex with, regardless of how you might think of what your internal gender identity is, if you don't appear to conform to gender norms, then you're going to be at risk of homophobia or transphobia. And so we can see that homophobia and transphobia then pop up this gender system, which is essential to sexism. And so one big connection between queer and animal liberation is that my gosh, sexism and speciesism are just inextricably linked. We can't even say which came first. When patriarchal cultures appear on the historical record, you know, some 5,000 years ago, they always appear among animal herding people, and you'll always see this same pattern where the male head of the household is the owner of the wife and of the daughters and of the dairy cows all. And the same ideas are applied to them. So if homophobia exists in large part to help prop up this gender system, and the gender system is itself inextricably linked to to speciesism, then there's one connection there. I see sexism and speciesism as two sides of the same coin, that coin being control of reproduction for purposes of profit. Control of reproduction for purposes of profit. And anybody would care about your sexual orientation except for the importance of controlling reproduction. And so whether it's a husband who believes that he has the right to control the reproduction of his wife, whether it's the practices of animal husbandry, who believe that they have the right to control the reproduction of non-human animals so that they can profit from their labor or from their bodies, or the person who enslaves people of another race or another religion or who are marked as other in some way, that too will depend on controlling their reproduction. So that's another big connection. For me, personally, I think I experience the deepest link as being about liberating desire from socially constructed avenues. What I mean by that is that I actually quit eating meat and came out in the same year in 1976 when I was 15. And some people might think, well, that's two different things. On the one hand, you're like reaching for something that you desire by coming out, and on the other hand, you're denying yourself something you desire by saying that you're not going to eat these hamburgers anymore. But I don't see it that way at all. When I look at it, I see it as the dominant culture was telling me that I should want a boyfriend, and in fact, I did not want a boyfriend. The dominant culture was also telling me I ought to like hamburgers. But in fact, when I thought about it, I did not in fact want to kill a cow. And so in both instances, what I was doing was taking back my own healthy embodied desires from the desires that the dominant culture was trying to put on me, if that makes sense.
How do you incorporate, or do you incorporate, this intersectional framework at the sanctuary?
So awareness of the ways that different forms of oppression intersect influences everything that we do. There are a lot of ways that we are a little bit different from other sanctuaries in terms of decisions that we make about things like, will we allow, allow the sanctuary residents to make their own choices about their relationships, or will we segregate them from each other? That, to me, is a commitment that's rooted not only in our commitment to true animal liberation, which means that we're committed to not just rights, which to me are extremely limited, but to self-determination and freedom for non-human animals. But it's also influenced by our commitment to social justice, to the importance of we know how important it is for us to make our own relationships. And so we're especially committed. I'm not sure if I'm explaining that well.
No,
it's sometimes hard to point out exactly how it is. When we were doing work around the so-called poultry industry in our original location, we made sure, this is just a different way, that intersectionality, awareness of intersectionality influences us. So what we made sure that whenever we wrote to the local newspaper or spoke publicly, that we were really, really clear about the ways of the industry hurt everybody. We were extremely clear about the fact that the birds were the first victims and they were the ones who suffered the most. But we were also extremely clear that this form of so-called agriculture was poisoning our local environment, had created a racially segregated labor market with people of color doing the most dangerous work as chicken catchers and slaughterhouse workers, working class whites being a little bit up as the ones who were so-called growing the chickens, and really only affluent whites as the stockholders in the corporation. They were the only ones who were really benefiting from all of it. So we made sure that our rhetoric included all of that awareness without in any way diminishing the focus on the birds, because it's all an organic whole. And that the other thing that we really want to do is we want the rest of the animal advocacy movement, the vegan and animal rights movements, and I see them as two overlapping movements. We need folks to understand that people make their choices, and whether based on a lot of different things, and by make their choices I mean their choices about what to eat, and also the choices about how to make a living. They make those choices based on a complex web of factors that include culture, that include their material circumstances, that include their economic circumstances, and because we understand that intersectionality, it's not just some fancy word about some intellectual connection. What it means is that every single thing that people do to animals is done by people in particular social circumstances, and those particular social circumstances are inflected by racism, by sexism, by homophobia, by all of these different forms of oppression. Furthermore, people make the choices that they make based on their material economic circumstances, and those circumstances also are heavily inflected by racism, by classism, by environmental injustice, by sexism, etc. And so this idea that we could liberate animals, that we could make the whole world go vegan without paying any attention whatsoever to the actual things that actually lead people to make their decisions, is just foolhardy. And so a huge part of what we do is just try to help people to understand these intersections. And so that's actually the focus of my most recent book that was just published called The Oxen at the Intersection. That book explores the failed campaign to bring the oxen known as Bill and Lou to sanctuary. We were the sanctuary that they would have come to. We initiated that campaign, and that campaign failed. And we feel that that campaign failed in large part because we did not take adequate account of intersectionality when we were planning our strategies. And those who were jumping in to also try and save Bill and Lou took even less account of intersectionality when they were deciding what they would do. And so it's hard for me to say very quickly here in an interview, but I hope folks will have a look at that book and have a better understanding of what I'm talking about.
Great. And do you have any stories personally of queer animals or same-sex pairings at the sanctuary?
Oh, sure. Sure. The first same-sex pairing that we knew about were two ducks, Jean-Paul and Jean-Claude, who were rescued from a foie gras factory and who lived at the sanctuary as a bonded pair for years and years and years and years. Ducks tend to be polyamorous, so I'm not saying they didn't go outside their relationship, because they certainly also participated sometimes in some raucous group sex. But they were a bonded pair. They slept together every night. And then in 2009, when one died, who had been ailing for a while from the liver disease that foie gras birds get, his partner, who actually had seemed to be completely healthy, died within a week. Mm-hmm. At the sanctuary now, we have several duck situations that are same-sex. Ducks are among the more than 300 species of animals, of non-human animals, in whom same-sex pair bonding or child rearing or courtship or sex has been documented. Male ducks, almost all male ducks, are functionally bisexual, and they're perfectly capable and often do form same-sex pair bonds or stable triads. And so we've got one same-sex pair bond, Inky and Ivory. There are two elderly male ducks who, oh my gosh, they were with us down in Maryland. So I don't even know. And then there's a trio. We call them the last three because they're the last three to come in every night. And that's a trio, two females and a male in a stable bond. And then we have another trio that's two males and a female in a stable bond.
Wow. And how can people find out more or get involved with Find Sanctuary?
Well, they could visit our website, which is bravebirds.org. Bravebirds, like courageous chickens. Since we started out just as birds, we just never changed our URL. You could also probably just Google Find Sanctuary and find us. We're on Facebook and Twitter, of course, as well. And, of course, I hate to have to say it, but the best way people can help us is by offering us material support. It's really expensive to feed this many animals, and we don't make a lot of friends among rich people by taking the positions that we take as an anti-capitalist, queer, lefty, feminist sanctuary. So it's a little bit harder than us. It's a little bit harder for us to touch up the animal-loving rich people than it is for other folks to do that. And so we really need the progressive folks who support what we're trying to do here to, if they can afford to do so, think about including us among the organizations to which they donate, or just helping us. If you can't donate yourself, then oh my gosh, we need so much help in terms of like signal boosting on social media. We need people to like organize fundraisers for us in their own town, and we also need folks to help us out and actually just do the work of campaigns. We've got right now we're in the middle of a few campaigns that we have some things that we could use some volunteer work. It could be writing, it could be doing some research for us. So there's a page on our website that lists those and all the other ways that you could get involved. So again, I'll just say check out the website, click on what you can do and look under volunteer opportunities and see if one of those things works for you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining me, Patrice. So that was Patrice Jones. For more information about Patrice, please check out patricejones.info or for Vine Sanctuary, vine.bravebirds.org.
You are listening to
PRA.
Buland Awaz means strong voice in a variety of South Asian languages. Listen to the beat of the South Asian music and the issues that explore the beat of the South Asian mosaic. Listen to Buland Awaz every Monday at 5 here on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
You're listening to 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, and this is Animal Voices. And I have a couple quick news stories before we wrap up for the day. One breaking news story I saw this morning was some 2,400 dogs were rescued from the dog meat industry in China just over the last week. It was quite an exciting story. Volunteer advocates from Care for Stray Animals Center in Beijing had spotted a truck that was loaded with more than 400 dogs on a highway. They put a call out through social media and alerted the police, and eventually they got the truck to stop. They saw that the dogs, they had falsified paperwork, and there was way more dogs than the paperwork said there was. And a lot of the dogs were purebred dogs with collars on. Companion animal dogs are getting way more popular in China, and apparently the people in the dog meat industry just go around and steal people's dogs and fill trucks with them. So there was 400 dogs in this one truck, but by the time all these volunteers got here and everyone was feeling all charged up about this, they saw more trucks on the road, and they ended up stopping like four more trucks, and there was 2,400 dogs total. And over the week, almost all of them were adopted or put in temporary shelters. Pretty exciting. So a lot of people stepping up to help make that happen, and I hope all those dogs have happy endings. I guess animal rights is becoming more and more popular in China, and apparently the Chinese government doesn't really see it as a threat, even though there's not really animal cruelty laws. And I think that's mostly all the news time I have today, but I wanted to quickly mention that in the Georgia Strait this week, there was an investigation. It was revealed that the Vancouver Aquarium is definitely involved in breeding and trading belugas and such. And this goes against what the aquarium and CEO John Nightingale had said at the Parks Board hearings, when they said they don't do that at all in Vancouver. But they do it a lot outside of Vancouver, and they help support the wild capture and purchase of wild belugas and whales to come in so that they can bring in new genetics into the captive pool in North American aqua parks. So yeah, big investigation there, and glad that that's hitting the light, and hopefully the oversight committee will put an end to that loophole. And now we're going to hear from the Wildlife Defense League, who has just started an Indiegogo campaign to raise $10,000 to stop the trophy hunt of bears in British Columbia.
The Wildlife Defense League is a conservation organization dedicated to defending wildlife from trophy hunting. Our goal is to launch an anti-trophy hunting campaign titled Operation Great Bear in the fall of 2014.
The Wildlife Defense League is committed to ending the trophy hunt in British Columbia. Our goal is to conserve and defend wildlife, specifically the wolf and grizzly bear, from trophy hunters.
So from September to November and from April to June every year, grizzly bears are hunted solely for a trophy. Grizzly bear kill numbers far exceed the limits set out by the British Columbian government. We must take action now to defend this species.
By documenting, monitoring, and exposing the horrors and the atrocities that are committed.
Our governments have failed in their responsibility to protect apex predators like grizzly bears, black bears, and wolves. And the time has come for citizens such as the Wildlife Defense League to step up and take responsibility for exposing these mismanagement policies of our wildlife.
Our campaign is essentially a campaign that's about respect for life and respect for the wilderness. We do not believe that bears are a resource to be exploited by the BC government for tourism dollars or by trophy hunters. We need to respect the Indigenous community's explicit objections to the trophy hunt on their lands.
Animals like grizzly bears and wolves play a significant part of their culture and should be respected and seen as more than just a trophy. These animals also provide to a lot of communities a way of maintaining their traditional lifestyles and ways. And they depend on these animals sometimes for their food. And the needless wanton slaughter and waste of them through trophy hunting is both an offense and also unethical practice.
The trophy hunt is unsustainable and unethical, and we must take action now to stop this hunt.
Wildlife Defense League is reaching out to our community and to people who support us and want to see an end to trophy hunting as well.
The Wildlife Defense League needs your help to raise $10,000 by September 2014 in order to be in the field defending wildlife from the trophy hunt. We're raising the money to purchase a Toyota 4Runner, communications equipment, and camping gear that will enable us to stay in the field and on top of the hunters for as long as necessary. A reliable 4x4 will allow us to traverse the logging roads that hunters use to spot and stalk wildlife. Communications equipment will enable us to stay in contact with each other, and camping gear will provide us with a base camp to launch operations from. All money raised will go directly to stopping the trophy hunt in British Columbia.
Already once in this century were wolves nearly pushed to the edge of extinction. Only through efforts such as those of the Wildlife Defense League will we ever ensure that that won't ever happen again. Please help support them in their efforts to protect grizzly bears and wolves in British Columbia.
Please help by donating to our campaign and join us in the fight to end trophy hunting in British Columbia.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show. That's going to be Friday, August the 15th. And do remember, too, that we are rebroadcasting every second Tuesday at 12 noon. So that will be coming up next Tuesday. You can hear a rebroadcast of the show. But what's coming up on next Friday's live show, Alyssa?
I'm just going to be doing a wrap-up of, I'll be talking about pipelines and how pipelines hurt animals after the endangered turtle event, which is Saturday, August 9th.
Excellent. So we here at Animal Voices, we want to connect with you online. You can go to animalvoices.org, and there you can stream shows from our archive or download them as podcasts. You can read our show blog there with detailed links to all the different show notes that we have. You can subscribe to our show via iTunes. Just look up Animal Voices Vancouver and you can find us on there. You can learn all about our upcoming events and do stay in touch with us also via our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver, and you can join us on Twitter as well at Animal Voices YVR. We do have a YouTube page coming up soon as well, but that is TBA, to be announced. So please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We do love to hear from you for sure. And we are closing the show today with a song by Consolidated. It's called Unity of Oppression. Please stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
Oppression. You know, we can't erase it in a pot of song, but the facts, we gotta face it. Men rape women and man rapes the environment, and people with the post-religious views are violent. How can we advance with a memory so short? We live in a society that kills animals for sport. And how can we discuss gender, class, or race when we can't respect the rights of lesbians and gays?
Racism, homophobia, xenophobia. We must destroy the myths once and for all.
In our efforts to make a difference, we specialize when the contradiction arise or fail to realize the damage is done to the Native American. These singular issues I just can't understand. How you can love one and have hatred for another. another. You torture your sisters while saying peace to your brothers. As long as we insist on being so aggressive, we will continue to play the role of the oppressor. When men and women, straight and gay, whites and non-whites begin to unite, when humans can treat non-human species with fairness and dignity, then, only then, is there unity. To all the white liberals and non-white militants that oversimplify the impact of prejudice, blame it on the whites and you're right, but it keeps us divided. That agenda becomes short-sighted. I hear you condemning all racist sentiments, and then I hear you making anti-Semitic comments. Instead of only allowing one type of equality, place the blame on each other. Yet we should be expanding our scope of understanding and hope, just posing some questions and make some suggestions. We don't claim to speak from a position of authority. We only want one thing, and that's unity. Make it back, right, for the price of humanity.